time in the last six seasons, the Dutch are the champions.
This is Gary O'Neill to win it.
They've got it! Terrific header, Callum Robinson, super ball in.
Great feeling, we have to treasure these nights.
Well, hello there. Welcome on to the latest edition of the RTE Soccer Podcast. We're coming to you a little earlier than normal. The Easter Bunny suggested we should deliver the podcast just around about Easter time, as is the Easter Bunny's wont. Did I say he there, James? James O'Toole. Is the Easter Bunny he or a she?
I'm not too sure. I don't know what we class them as, but it's definitely a bunny anyway.
Funny bunnies. Are you looking forward to getting an Easter egg? Or is that possible in the lockdown?
I'm hoping the Easter Bunny's able to get out and about during the lockdown, but on my way into work today, there was a couple of Garda checkpoints, but I'm not too sure they were checking out for him or her. But fingers crossed we get an Easter egg on Monday.
Bunnies are very quick. They'll dodge any roadblocks or any traffic core units.
Yeah, they're quite
anyway, how you been since last Monday?
I'm not bad. I think the weather has helped a little. It's been a nice couple of days. The kids have enjoyed it. We're not doing homeschooling Monday to Friday, which is a bit of a blessing in disguise, but I'm sure we'll be back to it soon enough.
How do you find the homeschooling? Are you good at it? Are you patient?
My wife would describe me as I have as much patience as a person who has absolutely no patience. So no, I'm not great, and the teachers of St. Mark's National School are going to regret giving me 4 weeks of teaching.
Wow. Okay, watch this space. And in years to come, hopefully they'll develop into fine young adults, and they'll point back and say, those days at home during that COVID-19 outbreak, wow, they were the making of me. And my dad, he was so cool. Anyway.
Yeah, probably not. Let's...
Yeah. Of course, this is a football podcast, so we should talk about football. And of course, it remains one of the big stories. Stephen Kenny's appointment as Republic of Ireland manager elevated to the senior position after the FAI parted ways with Mick McCarthy. We'll chat to Stephen Elliott in just a few moments. But first, let's hear from Stephen Kenny. He's been chatting to our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue.
It's a very, very proud honour for me to manage the Irish international team. It's a huge privilege. And to me, it's the ultimate honour.
At 26, when you took over at Longford Town, you were the youngest manager in Europe. Do you think in some senses you've been waiting for this moment to arrive all your life?
No, I don't think it was as straightforward as that. I think, listen, it's been, I love coaching teams, I love managing teams, and I've managed some terrific players and worked with some outstanding coaches in the league over the years, and this is the pinnacle of your career, this job, so... I'm looking forward to it now.
But do you feel in some ways that it's your destiny? I mean, you know, you gave up on the playing side very early and decided you wanted to be a coach in your 20s.
Well, yeah, that's a long time ago now, but a lot has happened since.
Yeah, well, what's happened very recently is because of COVID-19, the playoffs being put back to we don't even know when, and the FAI had to make a decision. So you've come into this job a little earlier. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it is very unfortunate for Mick McCarthy as manager that the playoffs were cancelled in March and cancelled in June. I'm sympathetic towards that. I think it's unusual now because now the speculation is that they're not in September. They could be, you know, no date's been fixed. They could be in November, October, November. So, you know, so we'll have to wait and see and prepare accordingly.
You've named your coaching staff, but the position of Robbie Keane remains unclear. He's still contracted to the FAI. Are you concerned that that might have an effect on how your tenure is perceived at the very beginning?
No, I don't really. I think. Listen, I have the absolute height respect for Robbie Keane. I know he's got on fine with Robbie. I think, he's been our greatest ever goal scorer. And I think... It was just that I wanted my own backroom team, simple as that. I think we've got a good squad, very good squad. I think there's other players. You know, we've got an emerging crop over a period of time who will influence the squad. But I think we've got a lot of talented Irish players, and it's my job to get them to fulfil their potential.
It's often said that you learn more from your disappointments or your failures in life. And what do you think you've learned from the times in life that you have been disappointed in football?
This is not a stepping stone. This is it. This is the ultimate job. This is what... you know, this is a job you would dream of. Irish fans, we've got tremendous support, and I think they want, you know, they want to look forward to coming to the Aviva and seeing a team really pass the ball, open up, and and really entertain them, and that's what my job as manager, I feel that's part of your remit, that, you know, to get players to fulfil their potential, that people look forward to coming, that there's a real team that we can go and try and dominate games.
That's Stephen Kenny. This is not a stepping stone. This is it. He's certainly enthusiastic about it all, having finally been installed as a number one man in Irish football. Stephen Elliott, former Irish international, is on the line. He is very enthusiastic, naturally so, Stephen. What do you think are the big challenges he faces now as the senior manager?
You can tell listening to him there speaking that he's very privileged and proud to kind of to get the job in the first place. But now he's the manager outright, I think he'll have a few decisions to make regarding obviously some of the players that are in the national team squad at the moment and who he wants to kind of bring up and introduce into the senior squad, because he's obviously going to be aware more than anybody who's been impressive in the 21. So it's kind of getting that influx into the senior squad of them younger lads, right? But I think he clarified yesterday as well that there's some of the senior lads that he's really been impressed with, and they've got a bit of a future with him. So I think his biggest challenge is getting that balance right. But he'll be well prepared mentally for this, and obviously it's come a little bit quicker than he would have expected. But I've no doubt he knows what he's doing, and I'm really looking forward to see how it goes for him.
And Stephen, are there particular decisions you feel he has to make? And if so, what are those decisions?
There's a few players there that played regularly under Mick, and I think it's no shock to anybody that I think the way Stephen kind of sets up and play, the way Stephen's team set up and play are a lot different to what we've probably seen in the international managers of Ireland gone past. So I think he's probably going to have to make a few decisions with one or two players, whether they've got a long-term future with the national team or whether their time has come to an end. And that's just the way it is. But again, he doesn't seem to be afraid to make decisions. Like you mentioned there, he's asked a question about Robbie Keane, and he decided he wants his own backroom staff. And I think as a national team manager, you should have that right. It's a huge job for him, like you mentioned, and if he should be entitled to pick who he wants to go and work with him. So the fact that he's kind of come straight in and he hasn't really, and I don't think the Robbie Keane was his decision anyway. It's one of them where that wasn't down to him. That was something that happened before he came in. So I think it was a little bit unfair to ask him the question about Robbie, because he would have had in his mind who he wants to be, which people he wants to walk around with him. So I don't think that'll be a problem for him kind of making these big decisions. But again, these are probably things that he hasn't had to deal with before, but I'm sure it'll all be a learning process for him as he goes along.
And when you listen, Stephen, to players who played under Stephen Kenny, be it at Longford Town, Derry City, Bohemians back in the day, and of course Dundalk, they all talk about his man management style and how he gets the most out of players. And in some of the press stuff that he did over the last few days, it was very interesting to note that he singled out the likes of Shane Duffy and John Egan and Matt Doherty and Enda Stevens, and talking about the Irish back four, and included Seamus Coleman as well. But the Irish defensive unit has been amongst the best in Europe. Already he's instilling in the players a sense of confidence and a sense of belief. And if you're Shane Duffy and you're over at Brighton and you're hearing the new manager talking about you in those terms, it's going to get you buzzing, isn't it?
Of course it is as well. And another guy, John Egan, I listened to it yesterday closely when he was speaking, and he seemed to speak really highly of John Egan as somebody that can actually, as well as defend, he can play football. He's very comfortable on the ball at the back as well, and he spoke about Matt Doherty as well. I think he mentioned their ages and why they haven't had more caps than what they have at the moment. So I think straight away, if you're one of them players, you're thinking, oh, this fella fancies me, and it might give you that little bit of lift to kind of to go out there once the football gets going again, to kind of say, listen, I'm going to show him that what he's saying about us, that we're right and we deserve to play from the start for Ireland. So I think he's got he knows what he wants to do, and that was the thing for me. He's confident, and he knows exactly how he wants the team to play. And he would be, I'm sure, although he's been working with the 21s, I'm sure he'd be keeping an eye on the senior players with a view to becoming the senior manager in mind. And listen, I'm really excited, as I'm sure the rest of the country is, to see kind of how the team start playing once he kind of gets in there and working with the players.
And you already touched on it, Stephen, the new players, some of those lads who are playing under 21 football, everybody's talking about the likes of Troy Parrott, and we know that whenever football resumes that Troy Parrott really needs to start playing first team football. But the likes of Troy Parrott and Adam Ida, I guess it's a question of when he tries to integrate those kind of players, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think another thing is will be when the kind of playoff games are eventually played. Will he have a few games beforehand to kind of have a look at his squad, or will it be straight into the playoff game? So these are a few things that he might have to adapt to as he goes along, because I'm sure he has. I'm sure he's well aware of this as well. He has kind of a couple of plans of what he wants to do up his sleeve regarding whatever way the fixtures come. But again, these players, you can't ignore these young lads. They've been kind of doing really well with the 21s. A lot of them have started now playing first team football. You mentioned Adam Ida there, who's kind of done really well when he burst onto the scene at Norwich, scoring goals as well. So he's definitely one that you're going to be looking to the future. Troy Parrott, will he go out and play? Will he speak to Troy Parrott now and advise him maybe to go out and get some first team football, or does he advise him to kind of stay at Spurs and kind of continue his development there? And these are things where the fact that Stephen Kenny has this relationship obviously built up with these young lads, he might be in a position that they may listen to him. And it is exciting. I know people have talked about the succession plan of the 21s manager taking over the senior team, and it's not something that's always been done, but there is positives to that, like I mentioned there, the fact that he's already built up a rapport with these younger players who are eventually going to be our future. So it'll be interesting to see when they kind of come into that senior squad. But again, it's like we go back to what we were speaking at the start, it's getting that balance right. But again, he knows what he seems to know exactly what he's doing. Like he's somebody that I don't think kind of takes chances. Everything he does is very meticulous, and he seems to kind of have everything planned out which way he wants to do. And for international football, that's very important.
Yeah, Stephen, we were talking last week with Kevin Deary and Sean Harrigan about once he trusts you as a manager, he's willing to put you into situations, even if your age may not suit. But he's not going to be able to do that straight away, surely. He's going to have to take his time about some of these under-21s. Like, for instance, the one player I could see probably going in would be Malumbi before the likes of a Parrott or an Ida, someone in midfield where they might take over from a Glenn Whelan or something like that. What do you think of that?
I think the thing as well is it's about getting that trust in the players. You mentioned trust, and these players, he's been working on the 21s. I'm sure he's built up these relationships and he trusts these players. But it's getting that senior lads that he will need to perform from that are already in the squad. So he's going to have to earn their trust and not respect. I'm sure they respect him because of what he's done so far as well in his managing career. But on a one-to-one basis, on a personal relationship, he's going to have to build these relationships with these players and earn their trust as well, which I'm sure I've no doubt he's more than capable of doing. And if you look at his managerial career over the last few seasons of what he's done, obviously Dundalk and then with the national team under 21s, there's no doubt he can build these relationships. But these are just little challenges and little kind of things that he'll have in front of him, and I'm sure he's well prepared for these. This is something that he's had a few years to kind of think about, because he knew he was getting the role. Again, another positive about kind of the succession plan. Some people have said it's not an ideal thing, which I don't think it exactly was, but there is positives in the fact that he would have had time to kind of think about how he's going to approach these situations.
Stephen, though, it is very, and you touched on it, it is very difficult for him, isn't it? Given there's so much uncertainty about when football will resume, talking about the playoff against Slovakia. Originally, you know, we should have it done and dusted and perhaps be on our way to the Euros. It's been put back, and there's talk now of November. We have to wait and see how things play out with this awful COVID-19 virus. But this element of uncertainty in terms of managing situations and planning for the future, it's quite difficult for him, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not an ideal situation to come in from, Adrian. He's like you mentioned there, nobody actually knows when football's going to get going today. And I don't think that, when you look at what's happening around the world, I don't think football is the most important thing. But the thing is, it is so important to so many people that it's important that we get back playing it quickly. But yeah, like you mentioned, it's going to be difficult because he can't plan exactly for one game, because it's not like, you know, I've got a certain amount of games coming up in a few months' time. He could have 16, 17 games before the kind of Euro start, and this could last for a long, long time. This could kind of be finished in the next kind of month or so. You don't know. So it's something that he's aware of, and it's not an ideal situation. And it's difficult for him, but in a way, you might give him a little bit more leeway regarding kind of results in his first games, because people might say, do you know what, like, no, things haven't gone totally to plan. He might say, well, it was a little bit of a tough start. He didn't have an ideal kind of preparation with not knowing. So he could use it to his advantage as well, but we shall see. And again, I think he's well prepared, and he knows exactly what's ahead of him. And I think the fact that he's Ireland manager, I just think he's so brilliant. I don't think he's going to do it. I think he'll do everything in his power to make this a success. And I know we mentioned it's not a stepping stone. It's the biggest job for him, like, to manage his country. He said it was the pinnacle, which it is. But I've no doubt if he comes in and he does a really good job, that people outside of Ireland are going to be looking at him, because now he's appointed Ireland manager straight away. He becomes... not celebrity, but becomes automatically much more well known in the football world. And if he goes in and does a really good job internationally, then there's no people kind of looking at him and thinking what he could do.
And Stephen, before we let you go, just a word on Mick McCarthy, because of course you played for Mick at Sunderland back in the day. Pretty rough way for it all to end for Mick McCarthy, given that it was his second stint as Ireland manager. He didn't get to see out the playoff against Slovakia. Now, he's very magnanimous in the way that things have played out, and he's wished Stephen Kenny the very best of luck. But unfortunately for him, he didn't get a shot at really getting Ireland over the finishing line and into the Euros.
No, I think it was a tough kind of ending for Mick. I don't think anybody would have seen it coming, but he obviously had a plan. He wanted to kind of see the job out, hopefully qualify for the Euros, but it kind of was taken out of his hands. Steve, I think Mick has to be kind of... give a lot of credit, because when he came in, there was a lot of supporters of the Irish team that kind of fallen out of love, so to speak, with the Irish team. And when he came back in, he created that buzz again. And he seemed to get the players lively again and playing for him. So for that, I think you need to give him great credit. But listen, Mick walks away, his reputation is intact, and I'm sure it won't be long before we see Mick back in charge somewhere else again, because he's a top manager, and I'm sure he's got a little bit more left in him.
Okay, Stephen, we'll leave it there. Many thanks for joining us. That's Stephen Elliott, former Irish international. Now to the effects of the COVID-19 virus crisis, call it what you will, on football. And of course, obviously with football, it's insignificant in the bigger scheme of things. But of course, people love their football and they're just crying out to see action on the field of play once again. Let's touch base with England, Scotland and indeed across Europe. We're joined by Guy Swindles, who regularly covers Premier League football for RTE Sport. Roddy Forsyth is Scottish based, of course, and familiar to Irish audiences. And Mark Langdon, a regular on Game On, for his knowledge on European football. Chaps, so many thanks for joining us on the line. Guy, I might start with you. English football over the last week or so, very much under pressure, various clubs. We saw Liverpool and Tottenham Hotspur before them, furloughing staff, and then in the case of Liverpool, reversing their decision to let staff go temporarily. What have you made of it all in the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's a funny one. It was interesting that as soon as there was a bit of pressure on the government over their testing, they managed to find another scapegoat quite quickly in the shape of football, and everybody was concentrating on that. Yes, football hasn't always handled its PR on the money front terribly well in England, but I think in this case, they were unfortunate. If you look at the size of a football club as a company and the profit they make, there are very similar businesses throughout England who are currently furloughing staff and claiming money back from the government. But because in football you have these very, very well-paid players at the top of the tree as far as the club is concerned, I can understand why there was a certain amount of disquiet at the fact that the teams were furloughing. As it is, Liverpool did backtrack. I also felt for the players because they came in for some hammer as well. It had actually started the day before in the morning that the health minister had a pop at the footballers, that Jordan Henderson, the Liverpool skipper, had contacted all the other skippers in the Premier League to talk about raising money for the NHS, which they've now done. And all players connected in the Premier League are contributing. And this is going to be quite a major contribution to the NHS. But it's been an interesting PR battle, I think.
What did you make? You mentioned there Matt Hancock, the health secretary, and his intervention last week. Some saw it as an act of deflection on his part by bringing Premier League football's highly paid players into the debate, that he was focusing attention on them. The players, for their part, they suddenly found themselves under fire. Now, amongst the general public and a lot of the football supporters, there wouldn't be huge sympathy for Premier League players in terms of the money they make. But immediately they were on the back foot, weren't they? And you had people like Gary Lineker coming out trying to defend players.
Absolutely right. Yes, we did see that suddenly from nowhere. The footballers were being attacked. Interesting that other high paid earners in English society, British society, have not come under the same scrutiny, but the footballers did. I think it was an easy target. They are an easy target. You can easily argue that soccer players are overpaid in comparison with particularly the jobs that are important at the moment. And you compare a nurse's salary with a Premier League footballer's salary, and you can see why people can jump to the conclusion that perhaps one can afford to take a wage cut and perhaps the other one could do with one. So I understand why football was attacked, but I think that the way they have come back. At first, you're right, there were the former players like Lineker and Alan Shearer saying this isn't quite fair, and the fans going, well, they do have a bit of a point. But I think that what the clubs have now done in the face of that backlash has been impressive, and you do feel that the swing of public opinion is now possibly behind the players rather than going in the other direction as it was a week ago when Matt Hancock decided to lob the footballers into the debate.
Okay, guys, stay with us for a moment. Also joined from Scotland by Roddy Forsyth. Roddy, what's the broad picture in Scotland at the moment in terms of football and the coronavirus, COVID-19 crisis that we're all enduring? How are clubs coping there?
Well, first of all, we had an announcement from the Scottish Football Association yesterday to say that the deadline for football to resume will not be any earlier than June the 10th, and it may be June the 17th. So as you can see, we're extending towards the summer. Excuse me. And in the meantime, smaller clubs in Scotland in the lower divisions are protesting that they are liable to go out of business because we're not at the stage of people paying for season tickets yet. People don't know when the next season will start. People don't know how much income they've got. Many, many people are in furlough at the moment. And so they need some sort of cash injection. Now, what they want is the season to be called now. And on the basis of points average, where you divide your points by the number of games played, they want the positions fixed so that payouts based on positions can be made now. Now, for this proposal to be carried, incidentally, that wouldn't apply to the Premiership. In theory, the Premiership can still begin again with the contingency that it should not be damaging the start of next season, which is designed to begin on August the 1st. So at the moment, today's a day of destiny, as it were, because there is a vote of all 42 SPFL clubs on these matters. Now, what the SPFL needs is 9 Premiership clubs to support their proposals. We know that Aberdeen, Hearts and Rangers have said they'll vote no. I know that Rangers and Hearts have been lobbying behind the scenes to try to get one more club to join them. That would torpedo the proposals. In the Championship, 8 votes are required to carry the plan, but Partick Thistle have said they're against it. Dundee and Inverness are in 2 minds about it. And Stranraer in their division have said they're opposed to it. Now, what links these clubs is they all have an interest in the matter. Rangers don't want Celtic to have a free pass at getting 9 titles in a row. Hearts don't want to be relegated. Partick Thistle don't want to be relegated, and neither do Stranraer. So when I was getting into this game years and years ago, a director of Clydebank Football Club, Jackie Steedman, who was a very good administrator, said to me, "One thing you will learn about football," he said, "and I can tell you this from experience, is that whenever people say that they are acting for the good of the game, I reach for my revolver." And well, I've been going for my gun belt like Billy the Kid throughout this week, because I can hear every club expressing what are sometimes put in the context of this good of the game argument, and which I very well know to be entirely self-interested. That's not a problem particularly, but it's not necessarily all that honest.
And Roddy, given that you've been involved in football for so long, dare I say it, what's your judgment call on this? What way will it play out in Scotland, do you think?
It's absolutely on the wire at the moment, and the claws have been out already, because Rangers, who said yesterday in a statement that it was abhorrent for clubs to be relegated unfairly, fairly strong language, I must say, in the circumstances, they said they had sent in a member's resolution which would have allowed for a payout to clubs at the moment, but the season being kept alive. Rangers then said today that they had sought comment from the SPFL executive on several occasions yesterday to ensure that the resolution was deemed competent. The SPFL have replied that their legal advice was that the motion was not competent, and that only at 20 past 10 last night did they receive an email from Rangers seeking advice on the content of the resolution. So you can see, as I say, the claws are out already, and it's still a little while to go as we are speaking till 5 o'clock.
Roddy, what is the football and public's view of it? How are they looking at it as fans on the streets or anything like that? Do they think it's a good idea for it to go that way?
They tend to be split down club lines, as you would expect. One of the interesting points here is the contrast with England, where, as we were, as you were talking about earlier, the bigger clubs were being savaged by politicians and by columnists in search of easy meat. That's not been the case in Scotland, partly because, of course, there aren't the same number of clubs with anything like the same kind of income. But one thing I can tell you on a good news basis is, now I'm a trustee of what's called the SPFL Trust. That's the charitable arm of the league. I'm not connected with the league in any formal sense, but I am on that board. And we get a spreadsheet every day to tell us what's going on with clubs. And there's a very significant amount of community help going on behind the scenes, most of it unsung. I can give you a couple of quick examples. I know an emeritus professor of epidemiology, and he's the sort of guy you'd want to know at this time. He was surprised to get a phone call from a Partick Thistle goalkeeper to say, do you need any groceries delivered? And the reason for that is, he's a Partick Thistle season ticket holder. He's over 65, so he gets a concession. And Partick Thistle, like many other Scottish clubs, have gone through their concession base of older supporters, made a point of getting in touch with them to say, we can walk your dog, we can get your groceries, what is it you would like? These are the heartwarming stories that you don't hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of them about, and there's a lot of them around this country as well, where clubs who are not in action but representatives of clubs have been calling on some of their older fan base to see how they're getting on in the coping with this terrible, terrible virus that is inflicting so much harm right around the world. We're also joined by Mark Langdon. Mark, you tend to keep a very close eye on what's happening in Europe, right across Europe. Germany, they're back training in Germany, not in huge groups, of course, but nonetheless, training has resumed there to a pretty large extent.
It certainly has, not without criticism in parts, I think it's fair to say, but it has, as high-profile a club as Bayern Munich, probably grabbed most of the headlines for their return to training this week. And when I say return to training, it's not like normal football training. They were all keeping the social distance. They showered at home. They didn't have lunch at the training ground. It was mainly sort of fitness work with a tiny bit of ball work just towards the end. I think as much for team spirit as much as anything else. But the Bundesliga is one of the leagues that feels like it's sort of further ahead in terms of their planning, you could say desperation, given the fact that they need to end the season for their TV contract deals, which said to be worth around 750 million euros. But that they're looking at sort of playing games again behind closed doors in May. So that would definitely put them ahead of anywhere else in sort of major European leagues. Whether they get to that point, we don't yet know, but I think it's probably wise from their point of view to at least start planning that. We've also had, of course, recently the Belgian league just decide that sort of breaking ranks really from the rest of Europe to say that they won't be playing on. And the Eredivisie was expected to follow suit as well, because Ajax and PSV and AZ Alkmaar were among the teams that wanted to end the season. However, the Dutch Football Association disagree with that and have put a start date in for June the 19th as to when they're hoping to resume their season, to finish it for the end of July and then start a new campaign in the middle of August. Of course, it's all well and good having these plans in place, but I don't think anybody knows what's coming sort of, you know, next week, never mind next month.
And you mentioned there Belgium, where Bruges have been declared champions, but UEFA certainly don't want countries going on solo runs, because they've come out and said, listen, we have to try and complete all the various leagues right across Europe. But the Belgian FA, they were having none of it, and they've decided to take the ball away.
Yeah, they have. I can understand UEFA's point of view. They want these European spots to be decided on the pitch rather than by just a football association, if you like. But Belgium, and they're not the only league that's got this issue, are changing TV contractors in the summer. And that has made life, I think, very difficult for the nations that are in the same boat, really. This was it's a much more lucrative TV contract that they signed. I think all the clubs were looking forward to getting their hands on the money. And maybe this is one way where they can sort of look to start next season on time and play a normal amount of, a regular amount of matches, whereas, you know, if teams are hanging on to play the rest of their season, and let's say, I don't know, it goes into August or September or whatever, and then there's a knock-on effect for the following campaign, I think Belgium wanted to step away from you know, that possibility and give themselves the best chance of having a good run at next season.
In many respects, and we've said it several times, Mark, on this podcast, it seems almost heartless to be talking about football given the backdrop of what's going on in the world right now, but and particularly when you look at Italy and Spain, who both countries have been hugely hit in terms of the loss of life there, but no sign of either league resuming in the short term. It's going to be a long, long while, you would imagine, before we see La Liga or Serie A resuming.
I would have thought so. I mean, again, there's suggestions in Spain from La Liga that if it's at all possible, they'd like to restart in May. But of course, you know, I think there's to be an announcement very soon about the continuation of the lockdown and sort of that being extended in Spain. So I would have thought that that's highly unlikely. In Italy, there's not been that much talk really about a potential date, because I think, you know, the problems in the country, particularly in the north of the country, have been such that that's kind of taken over. But you have had some high profile sort of names sort of stick their heads out and try and come up with a solution. Marcello Lippi, for instance, former Juventus and Italy manager, he says that the season must be finished. And then you get somebody like the Brescia owner, Cellino, who used to be in charge at Leeds. He was saying that, under no circumstances should they play another game this season, and Brescia won't turn up if they're forced into playing these games. And a bit like what Roddy was saying earlier on there, I mean, it may be coincidence or it may not be coincidence, but Brescia are bottom of the league and would probably benefit if the season was null and void. But you know, he's saying it's for the greater good of the game. Whether he truly means that or not, only he will know.
And just keeping with Italian football, obviously players have taken wage cuts this week. Do you think that's going to put pressure on what Guy was speaking about earlier, the English players having to take wage cuts?
In Italy, there's been probably a bigger argument than even there was in the Premier League, not between politicians necessarily, but more between the league forcing a 30% pay cut on the players that haven't gone down well, understandably so. I suppose Juventus have acted separately and are doing their own wage deferrals. I think it's really difficult for some of these leagues, and maybe when we talk about the Premier League, to get your head around the fact that not everybody, even in top flights around Europe, earns £70,000 a week. If you're playing for Spa and you're a journeyman striker, you know, you're only going to be on, you're just going to be on considerably less than that. And so asking, say, that veteran forward to take the same pay cut as Edin Dzeko or Romelu Lukaku or Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't quite work like that. And there's been a big kickback in Italy between the sort of players, the sort of PFA, their version of the PFA, you know, trying to fight the players' corner on this one. It's getting a little bit ugly. And as you were saying earlier on, you know, it's not the biggest issue at the moment, because, you know, so many people are still dying all around the world. And it feels a little bit crass to be arguing about money, but that's the situation as it stands in Italy at the moment.
Guy, I suspect you're a battle-hardened hack at this stage. Are you a London boy?
I have been. I am now out in deepest, darkest countryside, happily.
Can I cast you so in a role as being perhaps a Merseysider, a Scouser, a Liverpudlian, a Liverpool fan, in other words, and you're within touching distance of winning the Premier League, and you're wondering to yourself, will we ever get there? When will football resume in England? I mean, Liverpool fans, again, against the backdrop of what's going on, but in terms of football, they must be just wondering when can we finally lay our hands on the Premier League trophy?
Oh, absolutely. 30 years, and they so deserve it. I think What's been quite interesting over here is we still don't know when it's going to finish the season, if it indeed will. They've now deferred. We were originally due to start playing again in May. The Premier League have come out today and said that ain't going to happen. We will start playing when and if it's safe, but we still want to finish this current season. The small matter of TV revenue is also involved in that. But as far as Liverpool are concerned, it's not just their fans, I think, that believe that they should be crowned champions this season, whatever happens as far as the rest, whether we finish this season or not. Even Manchester City fans and players have said Liverpool deserve it this year, the only team who could still possibly deny them if things went very strange indeed, if play does get back underway. The trouble is with the English game is everyone accepts Liverpool should be champions. But the scrap down at the bottom and the scrap for Champions League places means that, as we have heard in Europe, as we've had in Scotland, people have very different views as to what should actually happen now between now and whenever this end of season does occur. Interest too on the wages front. Southampton have deferred their wages and it looks as if West Ham are going to have a 30% drop. So the clubs are now beginning to follow the guidance. Probably where what we thought was going to happen is finally happening. But yes, if I was a Merseysider and somehow Liverpool were denied this title, you would feel that natural justice probably didn't exist.
Okay, listen, lads, we leave it there. Many thanks for joining us. That's Guy Swindles, Roddy Forsyth and Mark Langdon of The Racing Post. James, when we were chatting last Monday about 2006 and Derry's run in Europe, you mentioned that you had a scrapbook, or you said you were going through your scrapbook. I actually thought you were joking, and then you put out a tweet around about that time. You have a scrapbook of old Derry City cuttings.
I do indeed, yeah. I've nearly every programme of every match I've gone to anywhere in Europe as well, all along.
Wow.
My wife has been trying to slowly but surely put them into the recycle bin, but no, I do have a scrapbook of it. all the good memories. And actually,
dating back to when?
I think my first programme was 86, late 86. Yeah, I think it would have been late 86.
The famous treble-winning side of 89.
Yeah, it was well.
Okay, what are
that.
Your memories of 2005?
Very bad ones. Should we move on?
Okay. I've got about the FAI Cup in 2005, Drogheda United.
Drogheda United's first trophy.
Cork City.
It was a much better, the weather was much better than it was in 2006. I remember it. Cork going into the game as favourites, having won the league, looking for a double. Against Drogheda, who hadn't actually, as far as I'm aware, they hadn't won a senior trophy up until that day. And a local lad to where I now live scored the second goal that day, if I remember correctly, Declan O'Brien.
And he's on the line. How you doing, Fabio?
All great. Thanks for having me on. And a nice distraction with nothing else to do really these days.
It is a bit mad, all right. A 2-0 win over Cork City, as James referenced there, a first major trophy for Drogheda United, beating Cork City in that final by 2-0. You amongst the goals. I have to say, I was having a quick look back at it. It's a lovely finish. Lovely finish. If anybody gets a chance to have a look at it, it's one of those kind of dink it over the goalkeeper. But it was one of those ones. This is to wrap up the FAI Cup. When you were running through on goal, what was going through your mind?
Yeah, you know, I knew it was late on in the game, so I knew it would be a clincher of a goal and a huge moment for the club and everything. And it did all flash by me at that time because I had a lot of time to think about the finish, to be honest. And, you know, it was a huge crowd. I think it was near 30,000 people that day in the old Lansdowne, and all the family were there. And it was actually our second trophy. We won the fourth division. We wrapped that one up in 2001. 2001-2002 season, we beat Sligo down there in the last day of the season, so it was actually our second trophy. But a real big one, and it sort of put us on the map, I think, of you know, that moment where people started to take Drogheda serious, I think, a little bit. And Paul Doolan obviously had real plans to try and you know, throw Drogheda, he goes down for Drogheda, and you know, people started respecting us a bit more, I think, after that game. Because as James rightly said, Rico's babies, Cork, were well fancy. They were top team at the time. Joe Gamble, George O'Callaghan, John O'Flynn, you know, an array of talent. And to beat them there. I think we caught them cold, to be honest with you, and it was a special day.
And you, of course, captained Drogheda United to that famous success in 2005. And as you say, it was the platform from which further success followed, because you won a couple of Setantas after that. And, of course, the league title came the way of the club in 2007. But in many respects, that 2005 FAI Cup win was the springboard for Drogheda, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I think the whole town got behind it, and, you know, people start coming out of woodwork, if you like, and, you know, which is great. You know, we wanted people to, you know, start coming to Drogheda again. It's a real hotbed for soccer, and I think that awoken the whole town, if you like, and really people start having a real appetite for the game. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of money then coming into the club, a lot of investment. Vincent Howey came in, and Chris Bourne and the likes of that, the directors, and they really backed us. And I suppose, you know, unfortunately, with the time of the economic downturn at the time was which we might be facing another one of them now. So it's you know, they do come around every now and then. But I think that was a culmination of a lot of things. And I just think, as you rightly said, the springboard was a huge one for the club, and it was great to be a part of.
Well, it was a great day for you as captain of Drogheda United, lifting the trophy, scoring the clinching goal. But the opening goal was scored by Gavin Whelan, and Gavin joins us on the line. Gavin, what are your recollections of that 2005 FAI Cup final, beating Cork City in the manner in which you did? And as I say, you got the opening goal for Drogheda United in that 2-0 victory, and you were named man of the match afterwards. But how do you look back on it?
That was amazing. I just listened to Fabio there talking about it, and then, do you remember the scenes, Fabio, in West Street in Drogheda the night of the cup final? I think it's stuff that dreams are made of for footballers, you know. But yeah, the day itself, was the whole build up to it was very surreal. It's kind of stuff, well, at my age, I think I was, 22, 23, you think that maybe your chance to go and play in England and win the FA Cup in England, or win all the things you dreamt of as a kid, and then you're in a coach and you're driving down towards Lansdowne Road with thousands of people, flags and everything. It was just amazing. It gives me goosebumps now even thinking about it, you know.
And Fabio mentioned the crowd that was there, I think a little under 25,000. But originally in that year, the final was due to be played at Tolka Park. But I mean, obviously such was the demand for tickets from Cork and obviously from Drogheda that from some distance out, they had to switch it to Lansdowne Road, the old Lansdowne Road. And it was quite an occasion, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. I think we got wind that the ticket sales in Drogheda had gone through the roof. So we knew there was going to be a big crowd. And Cork always bring a big crowd. They were league champions and stuff like that. So I think the anticipation for the game from us as players, we knew it was going to be a big crowd. And we didn't need any reason to be up for a game against Cork, because I think back then, it was a great rivalry, as Fabio touched on, some great players they had, and I think we always gave them a good match. Though I don't think they ever felt we were a pushover, and I'd say going into that final, while they might have thought they were favourites, they definitely would have had a bit of a fear in them for Drogheda, you know.
Yeah, on the morning of the match as well, actually, when the build up towards the game and stuff like that, Cork were obviously in the papers as being favourites. And they kind of got off on a good start as well. I know O'Flynn hit the post before you actually scored.
That's right, yeah.
But when the ball comes over from the corner, it drops to your foot, what are you thinking? Like, it is the cup final after all.
You don't think much. It was split-second stuff. I think you're sort of just thinking, can I get past? I think it was Joe Gamble, and you're sort of trying to get past him and just look at the break of the ball. And very, very little goes through your head, if you're being honest. I'd say even Fabio had a lot longer to think about his chance. And I'd say not much went through his head either. It's sort of instinctive, you know.
In the post-match interview, Deck was obviously interviewed on the pitch and said that his goal was the most important one of the night, to seal it. No
Cork,
surprise there.
He was probably looking for another contract.
Yeah. A lot of people forget it was my assist for Whelan's goal as well. And if you watch it back, it was actually me that went in for the header and glanced off my head and landed back perfectly for Whelan to smash it. So yeah, just putting that out there.
Anyone who knows Fabio knows that he'll always put a claim on everything in
it. Fabio, you mentioned it already. It was a very fun Cork City team. When you look at the players that were in that Cork team, the likes of Billy Woods, Gamble was there, John O'Flynn, Georgie O'Callaghan. Very strong side you were playing.
Yeah, I think I heard some interviews with the Cork lads, you know, since then, over the years. And they just got a bit complacent. And a lot of them have said that they were on the beer, not to take it away from us, but we knew all, you know, they were you know, the Spice Boys of the league, if you like. They were, they had all the resources that we wouldn't have. They used to run in at games and at flip flops and big time Charlie's, like, but they deserved it at the time. They you know, they walked the walk, they talked the talk, if you like. But we certainly caught a cold that day, and I think they would have learned the lesson after that. And George O'Callaghan, who I've since played with at the Dock after that, he explained exactly that to me. That he said, listen, he goes, we probably didn't prepare the way we should have prepared.
Gavin, you come, of course, from a famous football dynasty, the Whelan name, and of course your dad, Paul, lifted the cup with Bowes, and of course Ronnie is also a family member as well. But having played football for a few years, to win an FAI Cup, to achieve what your dad had achieved, that must have been really special on the day, was it?
Yeah, it's actually, it goes one further than that. My granddad had played in a cup final, and he had lost, and then my dad had won it. I'm not sure if my granddad won the cup, but there's some sort of a statistic anyway where there's three generations in the FAI Cup. And yeah, I knew going into the game that my nanny was very unwell in the build-up, and she was in the crowd, and it was a very special occasion for me, and with the family name and stuff that, and then to get the goal, and you mentioned the man of the match. Now, I think the man of the match might have been a bit of a fix, because Roddy's a good mate of my dad, so I heard there was a few points promised to Roddy if he gave me man of the match. So it was a brilliant occasion, and the significance of the family name.
I spoke to Roddy after that, and he actually did confirm that is very true.
Gavin, nowadays you're involved in a sport which I wasn't aware of at all, tech ball. I was having a look at it last night.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's like football meets table tennis. Could you explain for our podcast listeners what it's about?
Yeah, I'll gladly explain. We're also running a 50% off promotion at the moment. I'm joking. It's a new sport that's based on, as you said, football and table tennis combined. So it's been taken to kind of the football world by a bit of storm. So we've 18 of the Premier League teams in the UK are using it in their academies and in their first team training centres, and then we've got orders from everyone and anyone. So we've Neymar, Suarez, we've got Coutinho, all big names using it in their back gardens and stuff. So it's been a bit of a craze, and it's really, really exciting, and it's a fun company to work for, you know. So as you said, it's like more and more people are starting to kind of research it and learn about it, and when you get playing it, it's great crack and very addictive, you know. So the future ambitions is to take it all the way to the Olympics in 2028 is the goal, and the company behind them in Budapest are very well resourced. So one of the guys is a billionaire, and he's financing the whole project. So there's huge ambitions to take it all the way to the Olympics, but for now I'm just enjoying the ride and getting to work with some amazing players and teams and retailers and stuff like that. So it's been great fun, you know.
And just to explain further, when we say it's like football meets table tennis, it's a table, it's a sloped on either side.
Yeah.
You could have, you know, a doubles match. So it's basically like table tennis after that, where you knock the ball over. And there's a bit of volleyball almost about it as well.
Yeah, it's very like head tennis. So I'd say everyone who's kind of been around football circles will be familiar with the kind of the net on the ground, and you play, or squares when you were kids growing up. It's very like that, but it's just it's kind of translated onto a table tennis table, which is curved at either end. So the ball bounces towards the feet to kind of promote technical ability with using your feet. I think the doubles game is great fun because you can have a bit of banter with friends, and it promotes kind of communication and first touch for younger kids, you know. So there's lots and lots of benefits to it, and most of all it's great fun, you know.
And are there any leagues going, any competitive leagues at this stage, or is it still in its infancy?
It's in its infancy in Ireland, but on the kind of European scene and international scene, we have a Tech Ball World Championships. So the founders have put up like an annual prize fund of €150,000, and they have a big kind of spectacle in Budapest last year, and in Reims in France the year previous. So there's been three World Championships now. I think we're into the fourth year this year of the World Championships. So on the international side, it's been really, really well received. And we have some good players. Brian Riley here in Ireland did very well, got to the quarterfinals of the World Championships in the singles. We had a good double showing in the first year. So there are people playing it in Ireland. It's just very young and very new. So that's kind of partly my role, is to try and grow the sport here as well. But mostly I look after the international market. So If there's anyone out there that wants to set up an Irish federation or wants to get involved, let me know, you know.
Okay, and how do they go about doing that?
Do I do the real sales plug? Gavin.Whelan@techball.com is probably the easiest way to get in touch.
And various websites, and check it out on YouTube. Yeah, I'd say Fabio O'Brien would be pretty nifty at it as well, would he?
I'd say you would. I'd say me and Fabio would be a good team. I'd be the steady Eddie, and Fabio can go for all the flare shots, you know.
No, I've seen it played, Gav. A lot of footballers' Instagrams now. It seems to be the craze, all right. It looks great fun, and as you said, it's technical ability. It certainly helps with younger kids as well. I think it's brilliant. Very innovative.
Okay, listen, lads, well done. Many thanks for joining us, and thanks for reminiscing about that FAI Cup final win back in 2005. That's Declan Fabio O'Brien and Gavin Whelan, both scorers on the day in that 2-0 victory over Cork City. James, that's pretty much it. Don't eat too many Easter eggs come Sunday.
I'll try not to. I am still trying to continue my marathon preparations. Fingers crossed the Dublin Marathon still goes ahead, but can't be eating too much chocolate on Monday, in fairness.
All right, listen, we leave it there. Until the next time, from all of us on the RTE Soccer Podcast, bye-bye.